in this audience today. We'll proceed with the oral argument. And Attorney Lester Pines, representing the Wisconsin Professional Police Association, is first.
May it please the court, I am Lester Pines of Colin Weston Pines & Bach, and I represent the petitioners of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association and individuals who are also petitioners along with that organization.
Mr. Pines, the court asked me to ask each of the presenters to tell us which questions you are going to address, so that we can kind of sort of keep score and know what we're going to hear, if that's all right.
Oh, I'll be happy to do that.
Okay, Mr. Pines.
I intend to address, in the time allotted to me, two issues. The first being the $200 million credit for employers against their unfunded accrued liabilities, and also the change in the effective rate, the assumed rate, and the change in the rate of salary increases. So those are the two issues that I want to address, and I'd like to start off by talking about the $200 million transfer. And I think the very first and most important point that the court must focus on is this fact, that is, that the money in the trust is the property of the participants in the plan. About this, I don't think there is any dispute. The court's prior cases, I believe, have made it quite clear that the participants have an interest in that trust. It is a property interest.
You don't include within the word participants employers.
Employers are not participants. And Justice Babich, you anticipated my second point. Participants are people who are vested. Employers are not vested in the fund for any purpose whatsoever.
Never get the money back?
Beg your pardon?
They never get the money back?
They never get the money back that they paid into the fund. That is correct. That is not to say that their contribution rates might not be adjusted. But once the money goes into the fund from an employer as a contribution or as a payment on an unfunded accrued liability, that money no longer belongs to the employer actually or beneficially.
What's the difference, counsel? You are complaining that the, and I use complaining in a very general sense, you have specific legal arguments, but you are attacking the $200 million distribution to the employer account because you suggest that it gives credit to the employers. You just finished saying that the contribution rates of the employer can be adjusted. Seems to me, if you prevail on the $200 million argument, as opposed to the $64 million question, whatever it is, the $200 million argument, that it will then stay in the fund, that is, in the employer contribution fund, will result in the adjustment of rates and really be a de facto credit to the employer. So what you're protesting in the front door, they're going to have in the back door. Explain to me if I'm wrong and why.
Okay. When the $200 million stays in the trust fund, it becomes part of the entire fund of money that is managed by the trust fund board. That $200 million is there permanently and the contribution rates of the employer may be affected depending on the performance of the fund. Now, for years, the employer's contributions have gone down because the fund has performed well. If the fund performs poorly, if economic conditions change, employer contribution rates may have to be adjusted upward if the actuary recommends that to the board. The difference here is that employers have an actual debt to the fund for unfunded accrued liabilities. They have to pay that debt. If the $200 million was taken out of the fund and directly given to employers, directly paid to them, there would be no question that the legislature was acting improperly. What the legislature has done here is it has left the money in the fund, but has said, we're going to give you a credit so you don't have to pay that $200 million into the fund. There's no difference between the two. If the legislature had removed it, given it to the employer, and then the employer paid their credit, paid their unfunded accrued liability payments, the fund would still be short $200 million. There's no getting around it. These are real dollars. So leaving the money in the fund doesn't eliminate the obligation on the employer to pay in the money. That's the difference. It's a theoretical possibility that that $200 million will cause, leaving it in will cause the employer's rates to go down. There's a theoretical possibility that even with that $200 million, the employer's rates will go up if the economy changes and the performance of the fund changes. But once that $200 million credit is given through this act of the legislature, that money is gone forever. That's the difference.
I may have misunderstood a fact. Was the $200 million part of the $4 billion, or is it over and above the $4 billion?
It is part of the $4 billion.
Okay, if it's part of the $4 billion, if we were to agree with you, then wouldn't that $200 million actually go to the accounts and not go back into the fund?
In which the $4 billion is distributed correctly, arithmetically. Of that $4 billion, the $200 million is in the employer reserve. If the court determines that the credit of $200 million is unconstitutional, that $200 million is still in the employer reserve and can still be managed by the trust fund board. It's still there. If the credit is allowed, there are $200 million fewer dollars will be paid over the next number of months into the fund, and it's gone forever.
Could I ask you, is this the first time money has been transferred or credited out of the TAA to the employer reserve account?
This is the first time there's ever been a credit for unfunded accrued liabilities in this manner. Money is always recognized from the TAA into the employer reserve on a yearly basis, as it is recognized into all the accounts of the fixed retirement investment trust. So every year, the money is allocated arithmetically to the various funds. This is the first time that the legislature has gone into the fund and said, we're going to take $200 million of what is allocated in the employer reserve and give that to the employers as a credit. And I stress the word give, because to come back to what I said initially, the money that's in what's called the employer reserve does not belong to the employers.
Nothing like this happened in 1987.
No. In 1987, the legislature directed that money actually be taken out of the fund and paid back to the general fund. As far as we're concerned, there's really no difference between the acts, that is, between the legislature's behavior. In 1987, the legislature directly took money out of the fund Now, the legislature's creating a credit which indirectly takes money out of the fund. The effect is exactly the same.
Where does the $4 billion come from? Which account?
The TAA, the Transaction Amortization.
Well, you answered my question. That you said that the $200 million is part of that $4
million. It is.
Well, you, at least two occasions, you said this money comes from the employer reserve.
Well, when it's a two-step process. When the money is recognized from the transaction amortization account, it is then accounted for in the rest of the accounts in the trust. That's step one. Normally, that's the only step. Under this legislation, there's a second step. The legislature has said, now that the money has been recognized in the employer reserve, now take it and make it a credit. That's what we contend is illegal and unconstitutional, because the money in the employer reserve doesn't belong to anybody but the participants.
Mr. Pines, how do you handle the argument that, let's assume that this is a taking, but there's compensation being given for the taking. The compensation is increased benefits for the beneficiaries of the pension plan.
With regard to the $200 million credit, that does not cause and is not related to the increased benefits for the members of the, for the participants in the fund. That $200 million credit is solely for the benefit of the employer. Solely. And bear in mind, Justice Crooks, that the employers really do owe this money. It's that the unfunded accrued liabilities are carried as an asset on the books of the fund. There are a number of municipalities that have, in fact, paid off their entire unfunded liability. So it's not a fictitious debt. So it's as if I owed money to someone, and that person said to me, okay, you don't have to pay me. Well, that's the same, and they've given me something.
Do all of the employers involved get the credit, or just those that owe money?
All the employers involved get the credit, and those who don't have an unfunded accrued liability get a credit against their normal contributions. So that's why I've said that the money that doesn't come into the fund is real money that's missing. And what I want to point out, and I think it's very important, is that to allow the legislature to go into the trust fund and tell the trust fund, credit money here and credit money there, is very, very dangerous. The legislature has no business doing that. First of all, they established a trust and established a trustee who is advised by an actuary. That's how the trust is supposed to be managed. Secondly, the legislature is acting as in the role of an employer, so that the legislature has a self-interest. When that $200 million credit is made, the state of Wisconsin, as an employer, gets $56 million in relief from payments it otherwise would have had to have made to the fund.
How many monthly payments is that?
I believe it's 22.1 months, but I'm the record would correct that if I'm wrong in my recollection. Now, what's dangerous about this is, if the legislature can do that in this budget year, in this biennium, and say credit employers $200 million from the TAA transfer, then they can next year say, well, you know, the TAA's got a lot of money, distribute $10 million from the TAA, and let's have a $700 million credit for employers. So the state of Wisconsin, as an employer, can have $150 million in budget relief. You can't allow the legislature to do that, because that's allowing the legislature to balance its budget with somebody else's money. It allows the legislature to take money that is the participant's money that is supposed to be used for trust purposes only, and through what I think is a clever ruse, create money for the state budget and for municipal and county budgets. It's an unconstitutional taking.
Counsel, you indicated at the beginning that you were going to be covering 2 points, and either I didn't hear the second point or we didn't let you even announce it. I'm just wondering, what, not that you have to get to it, but I'm wondering what it is.
The second point is the change of assumptions, and I'll be happy to address that now. And I will do it succinctly. The legislation which established the trust fund is unusual in the sense that it established a trust. So the state is actually the settler of a trust. When the legislation was first enacted, the assumed rate was 7.5%. It's in the legislation. It's part of the trust. Then the trust was amended to add another management tool so that there was 1.9% rate for assumed salary increases, and this is used to calculate accrued unfunded liabilities. Our position is, and I think the law is clear, that once that trust is established, the settler of it, the state, can't go in and change around the terms of it. It becomes a contract with the participants, and only the trustee with the actuary's advice can change those numbers.
So you are claiming an impairment of contract?
Yes.
You're not claiming a taking?
No. You're claiming an impairment of contract. The contract is impaired because of the change of the trust. Now, it turns out...
But counsel, as I understand the law, even though the legislature can do this, even though the legislature did it, ETF could trump them by readjusting the rates. Is that correct, or is my understanding incorrect?
Well, my reading of the legislation is that they can adjust it because of changed economic circumstances on the advice of the actuary, but it's not clear that they can do that in the coming year. The legislature has established these rates for the coming year. Yes, the actuary could change the rates based on changed economic circumstances.
Right now the rates are both 8%, right? The ETF had set them at 8% and the legislation provided 8%.
That's right.
So you think the only question is whether or not, there's no question that the ETF board in 2001 could say put them back down to 7.9.
On the advice of the actuary, yes, it could.
So you're claiming an impairment of contract for 1 year?
We're claiming the impairment of contract for a year, and we're claiming that the court needs to tell the legislature it can't go in and fiddle around with these for future years. There's nothing, if it's okay for the legislature to do it for a year, then come back the next year and change it. And the problem is, because the legislature is not acting in a fiduciary capacity,
You don't think that the ability of the ETF to change that rate is adequate enough to protect the fund?
No.
And you don't think so because you think that the standard is too high actuarial advice?
I don't understand why ETF is driving at.
Why couldn't ETF come back in November, get an actuarial estimate of 7.5 and change the legislative imposed rate of 8 to 7.5?
The ETF could do that.
So what's the point
for the next year?
Why couldn't they do it effective this year?
Because our reading of the legislation is that the legislature has set that rate for this year. And the actuary doesn't come in on a monthly basis and do an actuarial computation.
But if the legislature could do that for this year, they could pass legislation that would provide that it was for the next 5 or 10 years, which of course would be contrary to the statute that allows ETF to come in and change it.
Well, our position is the legislature can't do it at all, and it's precisely that reason. What I was about to say was that the legislature is not acting in a fiduciary capacity. It is changing those numbers to change what it owes on unfunded accrued liabilities. And it affects that for this year. they can come in next year and do the same thing. We can't have ETF, for example, lagging behind the legislation all the time.
Counsel, in this change of actuarial assumptions, what is your primary argument? Is it impairment of contract, or is it a taking without just compensation?
Our primary argument is impairment of contract.
What case law or legal standards are you going to provide for us that measure what constitutes an impairment of contract? I mean, how do we address it other than it's a contract, you know?
What is the contract provision that's being impaired? We'll start with that.
The contract provision that's being impaired is the statute.
Is the statute. Okay, but what contours are there? I mean, what standards do we apply in this impairment of contract cause of action?
I would suggest to the court that the standard that's appropriate to apply is that the terms of the trust, once they are set, cannot be changed. That the legislature has delegated that responsibility to the trust funds board. And just as a settler of any trust, and I think what you're asking is what law applies to it, the law of trusts applies to it. A settler of a trust can't go back in and change that trust once it's been put into effect. That's our view of what the legislation is that created the trust fund. That's why we say the legislature cannot go in and change those basic terms, especially when the change inures to its benefit and not to the benefit of the participants.
Counsel, maybe this is a basic question, but I'm just looking at 40.19.1, which, you know, what the legislature creates, they can redo, they can uncreate. And I understand the argument about property rights, but it says that the right of the state to amend, repeal, by enacting a statutory change, all or part of this chapter, is reserved by the state, etc. And I just want to ask, how do you overcome that language when you're saying once they've created it, hands off, legislature cannot act? You're saying it's in the hands of the ETF, and that's the way it is. And that's what I'm getting.
Yes, that, and notwithstanding that wording of the statute, once that trust was created and that power was delegated to the trust fund board, our reading of the statute is that the legislature is limited in what it can do and what it can repeal. In Association of State Prosecutors at 563, what the court said was that the legislature would do those things that are necessary to protect the actuarial soundness of the fund. And I think that that's correct. And I think that that limits what the legislature can do under that statute.
So you believe that we had a stipulated set of facts discussing the actuarial soundness of this fund.
Right.
You believe that that's one of the concerns you're hooking onto, is that that's why this should be left in the hands of the trustee.
That's right, because the legislature is not acting to preserve the actuarial soundness of the fund. My time is up, and I know
Mr. Pines, in your brief, you cover more issues, and I assume you're standing on your brief.
We are standing on the brief, and there is obviously a limited amount of time on oral argument.
An issue that you don't cover in your brief, but I intend to ask all of the participants, is you've challenge the $200 million plus the actuarial issue and the cap, I gather.
Yes.
Okay. And let us just suppose that the court would say this $200 million credit is invalid for whatever reason. Where does that leave the rest of the statute? Rest of Act 11. I mean, you got definition sections in it, and you've got a whole series of sections. And a reader of the statutes, it's not always quite clear if one of these sections goes out, what it does to everything else.
Our position is that all the sections that of the statute that were challenged are severable. that the general statute on severability applies. The legislature considered and rejected an amendment which would have kept the court from severing any provisions, and certainly our position with regard to the $200 million credit is that not only is it severable, but it is so distinct from the rest of the legislation that it would have absolutely no impact on the rest of the legislation if the court were to find it was unconstitutional, because that money would then stay in the fund.
You're challenging the whole $4 billion?
We are.
You are?
Yes.
So $200 million is just the easiest piece to explain at the moment.
Well, it's very easy to explain, and it's very clearly unconstitutional.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Collins. Attorney House, representing the State Engineering Association.
May it please the question. I'll start out by addressing the question that was asked of Attorney Pines as to what I'm going to be addressing. I would agree that the two biggest issues that the court faces relate to the $200 million credit and to the actuarial assumptions. At least that's in our view. The $200 million credit has some sub-issues that are absolutely gargantuan and go to the future of this fund and its vitality. And that is, whose money is it, particularly the money in the employer reserve, which is being focused on in this action? And second of all, whose money is it in terms of beneficial interest? And second of all, how can it be properly used, or what limitations are there?
If I may interrupt for a moment, are you going to address any issues other than the actuarial issue and the $200 million issue?
Not unless the court asks questions, because
we're going to address the same time. Issues that Mr. Pines.
Right, and we do stand by our arguments in our briefs as well.
Those are the only two arguments in your brief, if I recall correctly. Is that right? You raised the $200 million, well, you also had the three-fourths vote
and the providing adequate funding, state funding, for the enhanced benefits.
You didn't challenge the $4 billion recognition, did
no.
you?
No. We do not see anything wrong with the transfer. Well, it has to get transferred at some point and at some rate. The TAA is really an accounting mechanism, and as long as it's being handled in a fiduciary sound way, from a fiduciary standpoint, that somebody isn't doing something harebrained with the money, we don't take objection to it. If it's being liquidated on a responsible basis, and we don't see anything wrong with the $4
million per se. So to that extent, you disagree with Mr. Pines and his clients when they challenge the one-time recognition of the $4 billion, is that correct?
Yes, we don't take exception to that. That's correct. What I would like to say about the issue is that, first of all, this is an irrevocable trust. Now, to the extent that the legislature is entitled under the law to make changes, and to the extent that it reserved the right to do so, it can only do so prospectively. It can't do so by taking things away that it gave. It can say, from now on, we're not going to have a retirement system. They have to live up to the promises they made to those that received those promises. So that's at the heart of a taking, is once you've given something, you can't take it back. You can change it on a prospective basis.
Established, of course, and that's an established property right in that, whatever each person has in that trust.
Correct, but what each person has in that trust is, to some extent, it's not like a fixed bank account. It's they have an interest that we don't always know what its value actually is. It's figured on an actuarial basis, but people can live to be 120 and be drawing benefits for that long. And there are some people who die a week after they retire and don't get to draw very much at all. So it's very difficult to figure it that way. The point is that they have a beneficial interest in all of the money, and this court has in some cases said not only in the money, but also in the process or in the decision-making process, that it constitutes the terms of the trust. And what we have here is interference in both those areas. First of all, we're dealing with more than $200 million. While $200 million is the amount taken this time, I would add that the $200 million in the scheme of things is a small enough number that it would not have affected the contribution rate this time around. So it didn't affect the contribution rate except to the extent of the credit. In other words, if you'd left the money in there, it probably wouldn't have affected the contribution rate. But once you pull it out and provide it as a credit, there's a dollar-for-dollar effect because of the way the credit operates. The second thing is, what the court should keep in mind, I believe, is that we're talking about the entire employee reserve. There's nothing here that limits the credit to a realization from the TAA. The TAA money, once it goes into the three reserves, is part of those reserves. So it's not totally TAA money in the sense that it's a share of the TAA money that went into the employee reserve. That means that the entire employee reserve might be susceptible to this kind of tinkering and this kind of crediting. The employee reserve has $13 billion in it, approximately. Theoretically, if the legislature were to see fit to do this year after year, they could essentially liquidate the employer reserve, have the employers contribute nothing for a long, long time until $13 billion or so was consumed, and put this trust fund on a basis where it isn't funded. It is only funded with employee contributions and employer's promises. Employer promises. Now,
Could the legislature pick and choose among employers and provide greater benefits or credits to one kind of employer than another?
I don't think the legislature can provide credits to any employer. I don't think it would be any, can't imagine how they would do it on a discriminatory basis or on a selective basis, but it wouldn't be appropriate in any event. It's not appropriate to take money that belongs to the trust and that is encumbered by the beneficial interests of the participants and to give that to some party that has previously given the money on an irrevocable basis. Now, the way the flow occurs, I think this needs to be clearly understood as well. It isn't a matter of the Wisconsin Retirement System Board or the actuaries getting into a nip and tuck with the legislature, where the legislature creates a credit and they go and enhance the level of contributions that are required. The level of contributions required to the WRS are statutorily defined and affected by appropriately determined actuarial assumptions. There is a method for doing that. It doesn't happen on a haphazard way where the actuary decides, well, we'll get even, we'll just take and raise our assumptions. They do it on the basis of studies, on the basis of standards in their profession, and also as limited by the statutes. What does happen is most things in the retirement system are amortized over a long period of time, 40 years, is not atypical. And so each year, as they shoot for a point of funding that they need for 40 years from now, they keep adjusting that, just like you send a space vehicle into space and you need to fire rockets to keep adjusting it because it's going such a long distance. We need to do the same thing with the retirement system. We need to adjust it in small amounts each year to keep trying to keep it on track to where we will need to be 20, 30, 40 years from now.
Which issue are you addressing now?
the taking of the $200 million and the potential of creating a paradigm under which additional takings of this type can occur in the form of credits, so that the employer reserve is depleted or substantially depleted, and the targeting of the needs for properly funding the system and providing for the benefits of the tens of thousands of people that rely on the system doesn't get impacted in a way that those obligations will not be met.
That brings me, I guess, to an area of concern that has been expressed previously about the actuarial soundness. You entered into a stipulation with the other parties. Provision 54 of the stipulation says the trust fund is not financially troubled, and implementation of Act 11 by itself will not make it so. How much did the TAA have when this act was passed, Act 11? Do you recall?
No, I don't.
Maybe about $11 billion?
It was about $11 billion, I think.
And $4 billion is transferred?
Yes.
I remember reading that last April, about $1.5 billion was lost in the TAA account on investments. I don't know what the, we're dealing with big numbers, but if you go from 11 and you take away 4, and then in April you take away another 1.5, and I don't know what happened in May, where are we today on the issue of actuarial soundness?
Well, I don't think the actuarial soundness of the fund has been threatened at any point in recent memory, certainly not in my memory. And that is not the point. The government cannot do a taking from somebody just because it has a lot of money. That isn't what determines appropriate taking, is whether the person who's being taken from has sufficient assets to have that happen. Our point, SEA's point,
no, is... The reason I ask the question is because if a transfer is going to impair the actuarial soundness, then a transfer will be prohibited under our law, right?
Okay, that would be one grounds for...
Look at Association of State Prosecutors that was referenced previously. I mean,
but that didn't establish that as the standard. That certainly could be, on a given fact situation, that might by itself determine inappropriateness, but it doesn't mean that when you don't go that far, when you take a mere $200 million, that then you don't have that principle intruding. The point is there are systemic issues that need to be addressed, and the court has recognized those in the past as well, that if you create a principle or an allowance for somebody to do something that can set up a pattern or a principle or a right to continue to do it on some basis, that in itself can do ultimate harm to the fund and make it non-viable. This taking is $200 million. It doesn't sound like a lot of money.
What about the $4 billion?
Well, because the problem is that the $4 billion, if you take a look at the $3.8 billion, other than the $200 million, that money has been distributed to the three funds, essentially the three funds, there's some exceptions, to the three funds on a prorated basis, and has been used in the way, or targeted to be used in the way that it's supposed to be used. The fact that it's a lot of money or an aberration or an acceleration of the realization doesn't affect the fact that it's an appropriate use of the money. It's the $200 million that's being earmarked to a different use, to a credit that goes for the benefit of employers, not for the benefit of employees or the benefit of participants. And the participants, while there could be adjustments that go over the years, those adjustments are not made in 1 year. You don't know how they're going to be made. And you end up with a situation where the adjustments that are made from year to year may be funded because of the statutes, may have to be funded by the participants. In other words, is a credit being given to the employers? If that credit ultimately results in a shortage of money in the funds so that the contribution rates have to be increased, guess who has to pay 50% of it? It's the employees. So they're effectively paying back some of that $200 million, plus the interest that $200 million would have earned. That's the trouble with this. This is a very complicated system, and it's very difficult to take a chunk here and a chunk there and not have it impact in some way on the way the program functions. And once you get that rolling and say it's okay to do that, then one has to watch out for the aggregate amount of money that's there and what can be done with it piecemeal or in one shot over the course of time. That's the danger. So the first question is, whose money is it? And if the money belongs to the participants, if it's their beneficial interest that encumbers that money, state has no business taking any of it for its beneficial interest. That's the fundamental point that's at issue.
Can we turn to the actuarial estimates for just a moment? I've got 40.02 sub 7 in front of me, and in it, the legislature sets the rates. The legislature says in this one that I've got 7.5%, but they said 8%. But then it goes on to say that the rates are 7.5 and 1.9% for salaries. Unless, due to changed economic circumstances, the actuary recommends and the board approves a different rate. Now, Mr. Pine said that he reads that statute to say they can't do that in the same year. But, of course, I don't see those words in the statute. Do you agree with Mr. Pines?
Well, I don't think it's a matter of doing it in the same year. I think the problem, I don't share the view exactly the way Mr. Pines articulated it. To me, this is the difference. That what the legislature did is on a non-actuarial basis, in other words, on a political basis, determine the rate. And then they put in that when you have changed economic circumstances, you can change the rate. But that means that the rate that was set up by the legislature is the rate assigned to the current economic circumstances. So it's an artificial rate that they assigned to it, that they made a change on. It has no basis in changed economic circumstances. And the actuary, in order to honestly fulfill his or her function, needs to demonstrate or have demonstrated to them that there are changed economic circumstances that justify changing the figure that the legislature put in there. But whether that occurs in a year, a month, I don't know that it matters.
So you do agree that the ETF, the board, can change whatever legislative assumptions are put in at any time?
No, well, but only if there are changed economic circumstances from the time at which the baseline was created.
Okay. One other question on this. What is the contractual rate that your client has in these assumptions? You say, I take it you are arguing an impairment of contract.
Well, fundamentally, it goes that we have a trust that it's supposed to be run on a fiduciary basis. And running a trust on a fiduciary basis, particularly distributing money over long periods of time to tens of thousands of people, the only way you can run it is to come up with numbers on a good faith basis. Actuarial numbers are done on a good faith basis in a discipline that is designed or has been created to deal with those things on an objective basis. And when the legislature comes in and says, we're not going to do it on the basis of actuaries making these determinations, we need to come up with money to fund some kind of program or some kind of goal that we have, and one way we're going to come up with that money is to start changing the actuarial assumptions. It becomes a funding mechanism that has nothing to do with actuarial principles. It has to do with political issues that happen to be of moment at a given point in time. It's expediency.
But you seem to be challenging the statute that existed then. Prior to the passage of Act 11, the legislature's always had this power, right? This statute has remained unchanged for some time.
Right, but it had a number And I don't know where that number came from, but it had a number, and the actuaries from the time that that statute was created, the actuaries took it from that point and were fulfilling the requirements of the statute. Now the legislature suspends that statute in effect and says, we're going to put in a non-actuarial number, one that we want to put in. And we're doing it because we need to come up with money to fund these enhancements to the program.
But in actuality, they came up with the same figure that the ETF board did. Right? 8%.
Well, that wasn't adopted yet.
That was the assumed rate. Didn't the ETF board have an assumed rate of 8%?
I don't think that had been adopted yet.
Well, I can ask Ms.
But our point is, Your Honor, our point is that is just an inappropriate way to do it. If there's a coincidence where the rates might be the same or might be close, that's fine, but the principle remains that it shouldn't be done using non-actuarial means.
My point is it seems to me that you are challenging the statute. You are not challenging sub 7, 42.02 sub 7. You're not challenging Act 11 because under sub 7 they had the right to do this anytime. You're only challenging it now because they actually did it.
I don't think they had the right to do it anytime. I think it was actuarially to be determined based on changes in economic circumstances.
The legislature never had the right to change it?
No. Not once, because it was
in sub 7.
Well, because it's part of the contract. The decision-making process for determining contribution rates is part of the contract.
What contract? I'm looking at...
To the extent Chapter 40 forms a contract.
Yeah, okay, and sub 7 is part of that contract.
Right.
And in it, the legislature sets the rate and says that the ETF board can change it. That's what the statute says, sir.
It says it can change it. There was a rate in place that was actuarially determined, and the legislature is saying, we're going to start over again. We're going to put a rate in place, and it's going to take a change in economic circumstances, not necessarily actuarial determinations. We're creating a new baseline, and to move from that new baseline, you need a change in economic circumstances. But the baseline itself was not actuarially determined. And that's what we're complaining about.
Following up on Justice Babish, I look at the statute prior to the enactment of Act 11, and one of the things that Act 11 did, and I don't have the numbers right, but in comparing the two actuarial assumptions, you increase the spread, right? You've got now a spread of about 3.4. The statute previously had a spread of 1.9, sets forth in 40.02 sub 7. That shall be 1.9 less than the assumed rate. Okay, so was there a problem with the legislature setting it at 1.9?
No, but when it was originally set, I suppose somebody has to set it at some point, and that becomes part of the contract, subject to...
Why doesn't the statute say, and we will authorize the ETF board to establish the actuarial assumptions? They're the trustees. This is a trust. They have a fiduciary obligation. The statute doesn't say that. It says we, the legislature, can establish the rate, and the rate shall be 1.9. And now, and you apparently have no problem with that, but now that it's 3.4, you have a problem with it. Why did you not have a problem when the legislature set it at 1.9, and you do have a problem when the legislature in Act 11 sets it at 3.4?
Well, first...
Tell me why. What's the difference between...
Well, first of all, I frankly don't remember the circumstances under which that was set, but if it was an original setting, in other words, it became part of the original establishment of the terms, then that's normal. And then it creates a system over who's going to make decisions or how decisions are going to be made in the future. That becomes part of the contract, in effect. And you can't jump in again and say, well, we'd like to set the rates differently so that we can, in effect, impact or generate a way to fund something by manipulating the numbers. And manipulating the numbers, not on actuarial principles, but on political decisions.
What account does this affect? If they change the number...
It typically affects the contribution rates.
Okay.
Contribution rates are figured on a statutory formula, and when you take parts of that formula, which are these actuarial assumptions, and you change them, you affect the rate of contribution that is necessary. And what happened here is by changing this, they had the tendency to reduce the rate of contribution. Again, a benefit to the state and employers.
There's a difference, it seems to me, of a statute setting a rate of contribution. That's not money that's in the fund. That's not tinkering with money that's in there. That's not moving it around and manipulating it. That's a threshold thing. That is, the money is not yet even in within the system.
That's correct.
Why can't the legislature do that? Why can't they do it as they did in the statute prior to Act 11? Why can't they do it in Act 11? And why can't they do it 2 years from now and say, 3.4, let's change it to 3.9 or 4.1?
To the extent that actuarially determined numbers play a critical role in the appropriate funding and the appropriate handling of the trust or operation of the trust, they can't take that decision-making authority away. That was in the last big pension case. This court said that they couldn't take decision-making authority away from the board, and that taking the decision-making authority away was itself a taking of property.
Well, counsel, couldn't the legislature do away with all employer contributions in the future, if they chose to?
In the future, as long as they honor the benefit commitments that are already in place.
In the past, right. So what's different about this? They're affecting the future, not the past.
Well, but
to follow up on Justice Bradley's question.
But you're talking about, to the extent there are people that are in the program, active employees, future contributions for next year, the year after, is a promise that's already been made. Those are people that are already participants. When the legislature goes to make changes, they can make changes with regard to people who are not yet participants, with whom they have not yet entered into a contract.
In other words, they've already made a promise to Justice Babbage that they're going to pay him so much on retirement, so they've got to make sure they've got enough money in there for him.
That's right, and they can't suddenly say next year we're going to stop funding that.
Because they owe him that.
But they can say we want to alter some of the monies, the percentage rate in terms of contribution. What would keep the legislature other than fiscal reality?
Or political reality.
Or political reality. What would keep the legislature from saying, boy, we have lots of money in this general fund? You know, employers, we're going to take the money out of the general fund, and rather than set any kind of rates as we do in the statute, 1.9 or 3.4 in terms of employer contributions, out of the general fund. We realize we have an obligation to this trust fund, and we're going to take that money and we're going to make sure every dollar is contributed. What's the problem with that?
Well, I can't cite you the section by memory, but there is a section in Chapter 40 that talks about changes that are made. If they're made on the positive side of it, they can do that, but if they're going to make a change that's on the negative side of it, they have to give choices to the employees to whom they've already, participants, to whom they already have commitments to make a choice whether they want the change or not.
Why is this on the negative side? Increasing it to 3.4 conceivably will ultimately decrease the contribution of the employer and also decrease the contribution of the employee, won't it?
Well, it may, but when the employer contributes money, they're contributing to somebody else, not to themselves. When the employee contributes money, that enhances their retirement. Whether they want to do it or not, I suppose some people would rather put less in. You know, to the extent that they're being forced to put in a certain amount, maybe they want to put in less. But it's to their benefit.
The answer to my question about hypothetical, about the state saying, we'll fund the obligation, but we'll do it out of general funds. What's the problem with that? I mean, why can't they do that?
Oh, because...
From the trust fund point of view, from your client's point of view, why can't they do that?
Well, because they have stacked... There is a big difference. You know, with all due respect to the state, I think the state has pretty good credit, but I would rather have a dollar in my pocket than have the state holding it for me. Okay? That's what I'd rather have. And I think when the state has a retirement system that it established, it agreed to fund, it put statutes in place to fund the retirement system, now it tries to figure out ways to get the money out of the system or ways to reduce it because it's changing its mind. And the state is going to argue that our credit is good. We're going to pay this money ultimately, so what's wrong with that? And what's wrong with it is that cash is better than credit. It just is, even if it's the state of Wisconsin, with all due respect.
Counsel, just following up, and I asked the preceding counsel the same question, but under 4019, it talks about this section shall not be interpreted as preventing the state from requiring forfeiture of specific rights and benefits as a condition for receiving subsequently enacted rights and benefits of equal or greater value to the participant. So your idea of having a dollar now rather than having the state owe you a dollar, but doesn't this give, just that language itself seems to me to bolster some of the statements that have been made that the state has the right to, in the future, to talk about as long as it's replaced by, if I read it, subsequently enacted rights and benefits of equal or greater value to the participant.
Justice Wilcox, that language leaves the decision to the participant. That's what it does. The employer...
excuse me for interrupting, but it talks about the state. I mean, the language I'm referring to is preventing the state from requiring. So I'm assuming that the participant is not the state. I'm just reading it.
Okay. But the state has to put in place something that is greater than what it's taking away. It cannot take anything away. And here, the $200 million, by the way, has no relationship to any of those other, in terms of dollars, there isn't any kind of quid pro quo here.
But I'm talking as a concept, and that's what you were discussing with Justice Babich and Justice Bradley. I'm just saying from the language in 40.19, the last part of the paragraph.
My recollection of the provision I'm thinking of in Chapter 40 allows the employee or the participant to make the choice if they want that trade. They do not have to accept it. They can say, I want the old deal, I don't want it. Even though you're giving me more, I don't want more. I want my deal.
Counsel, in a nutshell, this is the problem I have with your case on this issue, on the actuarial estimates. If you should prevail, it seems to me that what we would be saying is that only the board has the right to set the actuarial estimates, i.e. the assumed rate and the projected salary increases, and the legislature cannot do anything. Is that your position?
No, because the statute is very clear that the board doesn't just set a rate. It has to do it on the basis of actuarial input. All right, so you have...
But your position seems to me to take the legislature completely out.
I think that's true to the extent that the legislature is taking away actuarial input and is turning this in, is turning this from a rational process that's based on the developed sciences that deal with these projections. Actuaries do this kind of work. They have their code and they deal with this. And to the extent it takes it away from them and a trust kind of format and puts it into the political mode of we're going to decide what these parameters are in a political basis, you start playing with the very vitality or the very viability of the fund. Because if you take an actuarially determined number and you say, well, I'm not going to use the actuary's number, I'm going to change that 3 to a 1, over time, that can destroy the viability of the fund and its adequate funding.
Mr. Haas, what is your position on severability?
I agree with Mr. Pines that the court, of course, has to pay attention to ending up with a viable statute. But so long as the statute ends up being viable, it's clear that there's a statute that covers severability. And in this particular case, we have legislative history that indicates the legislature addressed this, looked at it, and decided to allow for severability.
The act is silent, isn't it?
It's silent, except it was a thing that was considered and voted down. So,
briefs, though, as I was reading them, I had a difficult time telling exactly which section was involved at any one time and which ones you would have go, that is, be eliminated, and then which ones were left to make it viable.
If that is a problem,
you're going to help us.
We could invite. Well, we could. I suppose we could have some supplemental submission if that's necessary.
All right. Thank you, counsel.
I don't think the court wants it.
All right. Ms. Smith, representing as Secretary of the Department of Administration, Lightborn. Ms. Smith.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Ann Smith, and as the Chief Justice has just said, I'm representing the state respondents in this case, Secretary Lightborn and the state treasurer. Both counsel for intervening respondents, Anthony Sheehan, and I will be addressing the issues that have been raised here. I'm planning to cover three issues, one of which I may simply cover in terms of response to your questions because it was not one that was argued by the petitioners today. The three things that I would plan to focus on are, first, the scope and the nature of the petitioner's protected contract rights and property interests in the Wisconsin retirement system. Second, the propriety of the various funding mechanisms that are used in Act 11, including the $4 billion recognition from the TAA, the $200 million employer credit account, and the change in actuarial assumptions that are used in order to finance the benefits contained in Act 11. And then finally, to the extent that you have any questions on this, I'd be prepared also to respond to the reasons why the benefits that are granted in Act 11 do not constitute any violation of the extra compensation clause of Article 4, Section 26, of the Wisconsin Constitution. And as with other counsel, even if I don't talk about the other issues in my brief, I do stand. Those issues in the written submissions to the court. I think, Your Honors, that at the heart of this case are the protected contract rights and the property interests that the Wisconsin Retirement System, or WRS, participants are entitled to. Now, all the parties agree that those rights exist. They are significant, and they must be protected. However, where we diverge is how we define the scope and the nature of those rights.
I think if you accept a rather vague and far-reaching definition of those contract rights and property interests that's urged on you by the petitioners, then what you will do is really reduce the ability of the Wisconsin retirement system to be able to react to changes, economic changes, actuarial changes, needs of its constituents, the other things that that system needs to react to in order to fulfill the obligations which that system has. However, I think if you accept the definition of the contract rights and the property interests that's urged by the respondents in this case, which are grounded in statutory provisions and case law of this court regarding public pension systems and the rights to participants in those systems, then I think you'll endorse a system that is allowed to respond to the kinds of changes that I described, economic changes, actuarial changes, the needs of those who are participating in the plan, and allow the system to meet the obligations and purposes that are defined for it in Chapter 40 of the statutes. There are really three contract rights or property interests that I think have been created. The first arises out of Section 40.19 of the statute. The second could be described as the right to the proper use of the trust funds, which I think also arises out of Section 40.19 as well as Section 40.01 and the cases previously decided by this court on predecessor and parallel retirement systems for public employees. And the third type of contract right or property interest that the WRS participants have would be a right to the integrity of the trust funds as that is measured by the actuarial soundness of those funds, the ability of those funds to meet the benefit commitments that they have made. Now, throughout the case, what you've heard both in the writings of the petitioners as well as their oral arguments are really challenges to the funding mechanisms of the Wisconsin retirement system. However, the respondents believe that unless there's some kind of a threat to the actuarial soundness of the funds, there is no protected contract right or property interest in the mechanisms used, the accounting used, in order to fund the Wisconsin retirement system.
Well, as I understand it, the employer accumulation reserve account had about $11 billion in it at the time of the passage of Act 11.
And about $17 billion in it at the end of the year prior to both the distributions, yes, Your Honor.
And you're only taking $200 million of it.
Oh, we're not taking any of it, Your Honor. We're utilizing those funds.
You're going to be utilizing $200 million of it.
Yes, sir.
What if that figure was $15
billion? Well, I think that it's important to understand a couple of things. First of all, as I mentioned, whether $15 billion is or is not okay, I think depends upon how you define the contract here. Right?
Well, let me cut right to the chase. The problem that I have with that $200 million is this. Let's put it in a different venue. Let's assume the court has a coffee fund to which each of us is supposed to contribute $100. And the chief is the one that's in charge of it because we trust her with the money. Babbage puts in a check for, everybody puts in a check for 100, but Babbage puts in a check for 50 and an IOU for 50, okay? And Chief Justice Abrahamson, after a while, says, well, we've got plenty of money in here, and we had a good year, nobody died, things so we had no flowers to send, etc. So, Justice Babbage, you don't have to pay that IOU. Now, suddenly, my other five colleagues get very, very upset because they've already paid. And they say, hey, we've all got a right to this fund. And Babbage is getting off paying only 50%. This is exactly how I see the $200 million, whatever you call it.
Well, I'm wondering, Your Honor, that fund that Justice Abrahamson is in charge of, is that invested in any fashion? So there's no dependence whatsoever in terms of the needs of that fund into the future for whatever the commitments of that fund are. There's nothing in that for interest earnings or other kind of investment earnings on the fund. Well, that makes your fund a little bit different. It actually makes it a lot different than the Wisconsin retirement system.
Let's say that she puts it into the bank, just to make it as close to yours as we can. It's an interest-bearing account.
It's an interest-bearing account. Well,
Or maybe even a mutual fund.
That or she gave it to the State of Wisconsin Investment Board. I think you're you are trusting her with these decisions, so I'll leave that to you. I think that the $200 million here, and
but I understand that it would be my five colleagues that would say, hey, this fund doesn't belong to the chief, and it doesn't belong to Babich, it belongs to all of us. And yet, here you're taking something, some of those funds, and essentially allowing Babich not to pay.
Well, it's an issue of what exactly you think it means to have an interest in the fund. And what does that mean in the situation here of the employer reserve account, as that account sitting by itself means to the participants in the Wisconsin retirement system? And what impact does that ultimately have on the contract rights of the participants, which under 40.19 are the right to receive benefits with reservation of rights to the legislature to change those into the future, to exchange them, and importantly, Your Honor, to change any other provision of Section 40.19 that it chooses to change. But think about it this way. The $200 million is being... Well, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Do you agree that the money that the employers have put into this, the employer accumulation reserve account, once it goes into that account, is the property of the participants and not the employers?
Yes, those are trust funds. Okay. That's correct. An employer could not walk up to the State of Wisconsin Investment Board and make a withdrawal to use those monies for other purposes. I think that's correct. But the $200 million is being utilized to pay something in those funds that are called unfunded liabilities. Now, we know that unfunded liabilities are created when an employer comes into the system and needs to give some kind of credit or service credits to the employees prior to the time that the employer enters into the system, or if there is an enhancement legislatively of benefits within the system.
Or in my example, I give $50 plus a $50 IOU.
Well, that's true. But then the other question is, what exactly is at the other end? It isn't always just an issue in this case. In fact, Your Honor, I would say it's not an issue of what is your obligation to pay in. The issue here is, what is the obligation to pay out? What does the fund have to pay out? What are the benefit commitments of the fund? There's nothing other than, in the Wisconsin retirement system, a promise, a contractual promise, that the fund will be administered in a way so that it is not actuarially, first of all, the money won't be taken out and given to somebody else or used to somebody else. I mean,
Right, but in my example, there's $50 less for all of us to buy coffee and flowers with because of my going on the cheap. Now, in your example, it seems to me, there's $200 million less to be distributed to the participants because you are forgiving a debt owed by the state and the counties and the municipalities.
But that's not true, Your Honor. And the reason why that's not true is that the $200 million, as you suggested earlier in your questioning, is part of a portion of the recognition from the transaction amortization account that goes into the employer reserve and would have always gone into the employer reserve, at least as the system is set up at this time. Transaction amortization account holds the earnings of the trust funds. And when I say the earnings of the trust funds, I'm talking about the earnings on the employer reserve, the employee reserve, and the annuity reserve. The $200 million is a subset of the earnings that are attributable to the employer reserve. Now, this is really in part an issue of timing and exactly how you're going to give the employers credit for the money, because the important thing is here, Your Honor, the employers would have always gotten credit for the $200 million. The issue is, would the $200 million, when it came into the employer reserve, have simply, under the system we have prior to Act 11, ultimately influenced the rate that the employers would have to make contributions to that fund? Or, in this case, there is instead a more immediate kind of application of those monies, if you will, or a more immediate reduction of those monies to the rates or to the amounts that the employers would have to pay in.
But counsel, this $4 billion is coming out of the TAA account, correct?
Yes.
Let's assume that instead of $11.5 billion, which they had at the time of passage of Act 11, there was $4.2 billion. And there was only $4 billion. So $4 billion went out, and the legislature earmarked
$200 million of it for this account. That would be $200 million less dollars available to distribute to the employees. Is that not correct?
No, that's not correct. Because the $200 million is the $4 billion that was distributed, Your Honor, was distributed proportionately and primarily across those three funds. Those are the only ones that are really important to us in this case. Not quite a third, a third, a third, but something about like that. So there was $1.236 billion of that $4 billion that was actually distributed from the TAA and put into the employer reserve. Out of the $1.236 billion, $200 million was set aside within the employer reserve as this employer credit account for payment of the unfunded liabilities. And remember, what the employers are paying into that reserve is both for liability on current service and service into the future, as well as payments on the unfunded liabilities, service credits, and things that already existed as a result of changes in the past.
I'm really perplexed by this because...
You want your coffee.
It just seems simple to me that if the employer fund would have $1.236 in it, that's what you say, generally, if this there were not this $200 million credit for unfunded liabilities, the employers would be paying another $200 million into the account. And 1.236 plus 0.200, I mean, the numbers, there would be an additional $200 million.
I don't think so, Your Honor.
Well, let me try this.
Okay.
You said it is to, the $200 million goes to unfunded liability. Is that correct?
Correct.
Is liability a debt? How do you define liability? If I open up Webster's Dictionary, how are you going to define liability?
You know,
at first, the second, or the third definition that's going to be debt.
Well, you know what? I think I'd rather have you, instead of looking at Webster's, go back to your decision in the Columbia County case.
How do you define liability? Is debt part of a definition of liability?
It can be.
And is forgiveness of debt what we're talking about here, or you're not forgiving a debt?
No, I don't think it is at all. I think there's a... And the reason for that is because the unfunded liability is not some set, static amount, unchanging over the course of time, just like current liability is not static and unchanging. Think about Mr. House's analogy to the rocket ship and having to make minor adjustments. Other than for about a one-year period of time, the contribution rates for unfunded liabilities were affected by changes in actuarial assumptions adopted by the board on the recommendation of the board's actuary, the same way that the contributions for current liabilities were determined.
So, for the state not have to, how much of its liability will the state not have to pay because of the $200 billion contribution to the employer fund?
The state will have to pay all of its liability, which is the liability to provide, not just the state, it'll pay whatever its percentage is. It's a sum sufficient requirement, Your Honor. It's a sum sufficient requirement.
Let me try to rephrase it to make it clear. I thought that the state government would say $56.3 million as a result of this $200 million payment for unfunded liability. Is that what's estimated, or is that not what's estimated?
Well, in terms of what the numbers are for dollars that the state or any other employer participant in this system will not have to pay this month, next month, starting with the effective date of the legislation. Mm-hmm. Those are set out in...
They're set out in number
58, I believe.
Number 58, the stipulation which you folks signed,
Correct.
That the state will save $56.3 million of the $200. Do you join in that stipulation?
I do, but I don't join in your description of that as the state saving that amount of money, Your Honor. The state will be getting a credit for about 22 months of what it would otherwise have to pay during those 22 months for unfunded liability payments. In the end, however, the state and every other participating employer under the system as it now stands, both prior to Act 11 and subsequent to Act 11, still has an obligation to provide some sufficient funding for the retirement system so that it can actuarially meet its requirements. In other words, the employer, what the employer has to contribute is what's left over after the investment results of the fund have been calculated in on an anticipated going forward basis, after the employee contributions have been determined, and subtracting those from what the actuaries calculate this whole system is going to cost into the future. So it's an issue of whether the benefit of recognizing those earnings is a benefit that the state or any other employer receives today, or whether they receive it over time as the $200 million is used to calculate a change in the rate of contribution that any particular employer in the system has to make. So, no, I don't think it reduces the liability. It redistributes the time at which that payment needs to be made, but it does not reduce the responsibility and the obligation of the employers to make some sufficient payments to keep the system sound so that the contract rights, which are not in the benefit, which are not in the way this thing is funded. There are all kinds of creative ways that I'm sure that the funding mechanisms could be changed and modified here. But remember, the contract rights are the rights to the benefits and to the proper use of those trust funds.
Is there any precedent for transferring money from the TAA to the employer reserve account?
Yes, there are two prior instances where that occurred. Once was in, two of them. Once was for the special investment performance dividend, which was in 1987. This court considered some issues relating to that in the retired teacher's case that it decided in 1997.
So and the answer that Mr. Pines gave me was not correct, was it?
I would say that his answer was not correct, because there was a similar recognition for the early retirement bill.
Isn't it virtually identical that, what was it, $70 million or something like that, $75
million? $230 million in one case and $500 million in the other case of accelerated recognitions of gains from the TAA into
was
the various reserves. In the early retirement bill, 1989, it was not challenged. As part of the special investment performance dividend, it was challenged, but no determination that it was unconstitutional or violated a contract or anything else was ever made by this court.
It was not necessary.
If this is invalidated, this transfer now, what would be the effect on the 1987 Act?
Well, one could say that if the transaction amortization account special distributions other than the annual distributions would be a violation of contract, then those would be a violation of contract. Those recognitions would be as well.
Is it too late to do something about it?
I don't know, Your Honor.
Well, but counsel, if I understood it, you were saying that this $200 million doesn't disappear, that what it does is it's just delayed, and you give them a respite today, but in 22 months they got to pay up the $56 million if it's needed to fund this program.
Yes.
So theoretically, if this had been done in 87 and the other year, there's nothing to recoup now because theoretically it should have been replaced.
Yeah, ultimately it would have gotten its way into this, made its way into the employer reserve in the end anyway, which is why there's nothing improper about the way this is done. It's a timing issue.
So that the $200 million is just going to be added back at some time if it's needed.
That's right. That's right. Because it would affect the rates.
Okay. Justice Babbage would have to put in the $50 if it's needed. If it's not needed, he gets away with it.
Yes. And it all depends upon, again, what you're buying with the money and what you promised to buy. And how much the price of coffee goes up between now and the time you have to buy it, for example.
The coffee firm keeps going on year after year after year. At some point, I get a credit that he has to pay. Simple as that.
But we all debate the coffee fund later.
Counsel, let me ask, in the two prior distributions, that is the one-time recognition distributions from the TAA prior to this $4 billion one, was any amount of those one-time recognitions used to fund unfunded liabilities of employers?
Although it was set up for that to occur, Your Honor, it did not occur. In the 1989 early retirement legislation, the accelerated $500 million was allocated first to pay for the cost of the benefits that were also enacted in that bill, with any amounts left over as determined by the actuary allocable to pay unfunded liabilities. And it ends up that there were no such funds available, that all of those monies were used to pay current liabilities created by the increased benefits.
Could you enlighten me, in those two prior distributions where there are one-time recognitions, were any of those amounts used to in any way fund any type of liability of a non-participant of the fund?
Sure. Every distribution from the TAA is used to pay for liabilities, if we want to call them that. Every single dollar that comes out of the earnings of the trust fund, other than those that are utilized for administrative expenses of the fund, is ultimately used in order to pay benefits to the annuitants once they start to take their annuitants.
For a liability of a non-participant, of annuitant,
Yes, and let me explain why. Because again, if there's the employers have to pay, or the employees have to pay a certain percentage set by statute primarily, most of which is funded by the employer anyway. Then there are the earnings on the trust funds. And finally, remember, there's that sum sufficient requirement for the employer to pay whatever is necessary after the calculation of those prior two contributions. So you could say every dollar that comes in from the earnings of the trust funds ultimately reduces this liability of the employer to make sum sufficient payments into the trust funds to ensure that the benefit commitments of those funds will, in fact, be paid.
Theoretically, is that correct?
Correct.
Actually, two prior distributions, no money was paid.
Yes, no money was allocated on a dollar-for-dollar basis to the unfunded liabilities. That would be true.
Ms. Smith, this is a very complex area. But simply stated, one would expect that in this kind of bill, there was a little bit of something for almost everybody. So the municipalities and the state got respite for $200 million over roughly a couple of years. Pay later. And that's of assistance, okay. What did the $4 billion do in very simple terms? Transferring it. What did I get as a result of that?
Well, if you were an annuitant, you would get an increased dividend distribution. If you are an employee, depending upon whether you are a 5% capped inactive employee or active employee or an uncapped employee, you would get the benefit of either a 5% or a larger, roughly 10% increase in your personal account in the employee reserve, which ultimately you could utilize to determine your benefits. Mm-hmm. And if you are the employer, you got the $1.236 billion share that went into the employer reserve account, and reduce the amount of money that over the long haul you would need to contribute in as a result of your obligation to make some sufficient payments essentially into the funds.
And what about increasing the cap?
I'm sorry?
What about increasing the cap?
Increasing the cap?
Yes.
For formula benefits?
Mm-hmm.
Well, if you are an annuitant who is going to receive a formula benefit and you previously were at a level where your initial annuity payment was capped at a lower rate, then you will receive the additional increment on a monthly basis in your initial annuity. However, you may be not a formula, you may not take a formula benefit, you may take something else.
And you think this is in totality a benefit for the employees?
Yes, Your Honor.
And yet at least two groups of employees are objecting.
Yes, they are. Don't know a good thing when they see it, I guess, Your Honor.
We won't let you sit down at that one. That's established.
Ms. Smith.
Yes, sir.
I think Justice Bradley was the one who first posed this question to Mr. Collins. Mr. Pines. And is there another way to get around this? If we should say that the $200 million is inappropriate, unconstitutional, now the $200 million, I understand, then would remain with the TAA?
No, the $200 million is already part of the $4
billion
that was distributed. It'll stay in the employer reserve.
In the employer reserve account.
Yes.
Now, would the legislature or... And because we've said that you can't do it, now there's no forgiveness. But in the future, then, could the legislature or the board, in order to make up for the Supreme Court's failings, adjust the amount, the rate that the employer paid, that the employer has to pay into the account, and eventually take care of the $200 million that way?
Yes, with some limitations, Your Honor. And I do think that those certain actuarial assumptions can be adjusted by the legislature. Section 40.19, as it was read earlier, contains that reservation allowing those changes. In addition to that, that statutory section itself, I think, indicates that there's shared responsibility for making those changes. But the limitation that I would put on that, Your Honor, is that you couldn't have changes that were so significant without some other source of funding or some other source of ensuring fulfillment of the benefit commitments in this fund. You couldn't have things change that drastically. And in fact, I think that... They would, and not only that, Your Honor, but I think that, for example, there's a non-statutory provision of Act 11 in Section 27, Subsection 3, that says, notwithstanding any provisions in this Act, the Employee Trust Funds Board shall retain the authority to maintain proper actuarial funding of the Wisconsin retirement system, which I think really, in a sense, is simply a confirmation of what I've defined already as the protected contract rights and property interests in the fund to the proper use, and then the integrity as measured by actuarial soundness.
Ms. Smith, before you sit down, let me ask you also about severability. What's your position in that regard?
Well, I think, Your Honor, that as far as the methods used for payment of these benefits, the $4 billion transfer, the changes in the actuarial assumptions, I think that those items are tied into the benefits provided and are non-severable from one another. So the benefits of Act 11, the monetary benefits, are non-severable from those things.
So you don't increase the cap?
Correct.
Yes. So if any part of this is declared, as I understood it from your brief, if any part of this is declared unconstitutional, the whole thing goes.
Yes.
Even the what if we declare the $200 million unconstitutional? Why does the whole thing go?
Well, That gets a little harder. I think it goes, and the reason I say that I think it goes is this. Although the non-statutory provisions of Act 11 tell us that the $4 billion distribution, the monies that come out of that, are to be used first to pay the benefit commitments of Act 11, I'm not sure there's enough to do that. And to the extent that there isn't enough to do that, then the commitments, for example, the increased formula, those are benefits that will become part of, or obligations that would become part of the unfunded liability. Because remember, the unfunded liability is either when you come into the system or you increase benefits for services already rendered, and that's what the formula benefit does. It increases benefits for services already rendered in the past. So to the extent that that $4 billion doesn't cover it, I think that's part of the funding mechanism and is meant to be non-severable from the benefit provisions of this act.
Thank you, Ms.
Thank you.
Mrs. Sheehan, representing the Wisconsin Education Association Council.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, I am Anthony Sheehan, legal counsel for the Wisconsin Education Association Council, the intervening respondents in this action. And I really had a great presentation prepared ahead of time, but listening to all the questions here, I'm not sure that I'm going to be able to get to those parts. So I thought I'd jump to the conclusion real quickly and answer a couple of your questions. Not to steal any of your thunder, but with respect to the severability question, I'm fully prepared to speak more on it, but I would like to simply say that I believe that with one exception, and that exception being the $4 billion transfer, that the remaining provisions of Act 11 are separate and distinct and therefore are severable. My first major goal, however, is to talk specifically about the $4 billion TAA transfer and the actuarial assumption, and hopefully to do that in a slightly different way, to do it thematically by focusing upon what I believe are the very clear provisions and mandates from Chapter 40, which sets forth structural flexibility in the system, and more specifically, 40.19. To begin to talk about the flexibility, I feel it's important to mention the fact that WEAC represents about 85,000 members, actually in excess of that in some way. And each of those members is an active participant, and therefore they have a very keen interest not only in protecting their individual property, but also in maintaining the security and the integrity of the system. And it's not done lightly that WEAC weighs in on this case to defend things that have such great import and impact on the system. The reality is their future economic survival and retirement depends on the system. But protection of legitimate property interests does not preclude flexibility to make changes that affect funding mechanisms to improve the system or to make it more responsive. No question that the WRS needs to have a clearly defined structure to function properly. But we cannot prize form over function. The structure should not be too rigid. And if I might make an analogy, like skyscrapers and suspension bridges, the WRS must be solid, it must be safe and predictable, but it also needs to have a certain amount of flexibility in order to withstand certain environmental changes. First, a few examples of the type of flexibility built into Chapter 40. First and foremost, as I briefly mentioned, the Section 40.19 reservation, which allows the state to amend or repeal Chapter 40. A couple other examples include the fact that participants are entitled to receive either a formula benefit or a money purchase benefit, thereby guaranteeing an option of either a defined contribution retirement system or a defined benefit system. The TAA funding mechanism and the dividend process, which allows annuitants to receive post-retirement adjustments, is another of this type of flexibility. And my final example, the ability of participants to have additional contributions made on their behalf to their accounts or to buy back prior service. All of these are various mechanisms that the legislature has set forward that allows the system to be flexible. And this flexibility is one of the greatest strengths of the system. It ensures the protection of interests of all participants over time, while allowing the economic conditions in the real world to play out. Something the Florida Supreme Court specifically recognized in the Florida Sheriff's Association case that we cited in our brief. And the court said, future legislatures cannot be bound from prospectively altering benefits for future service, because that would impose a permanent responsibility irrespective of the state's fiscal condition, which leads to fiscal irresponsibility, and would establish inflexible plan which prohibits modifications beneficial to a majority of employees. Unfortunately, the petitioners, by picking and choosing between bits and pieces of this court's prior cases, insist that any change whatsoever is automatically an unconstitutional taking and an impairment of contract. This is a narrow view which bars the legislature from making any change, even if the accrued benefits are not altered. And ultimately, I believe that leads to absurd results. For instance, if the current market conditions continue, the TAA will continue to grow and grow. It has grown essentially exponentially over the course of the last 10 years. It's gone from $1 billion to $13-plus billion. As the TAA grows, money is shifted. Undistributed money in the TAA is shifted from current participants to future participants. Eventually, the contribution rates could be reduced to zero for future employees and employers. And in essence, what you have is a taking by using the current participants' contributions and the earnings thereon to pay for future employees. And I should note that with respect to a question I believe that Justice Bradley had earlier about what is the current state of the actuarial soundness of the system, this court can take judicial notice of the fact that the ETF board at its June 2000 meeting reduced the contribution rates again for the third year in a row. And it must be presumed that it was done so with the full knowledge of the provisions of Act 11. So therefore, with everything that we've been discussing here today in great detail, the ETF board still believed that the system was actuarially sound enough that they could additionally reduce the contribution rates. Now, I want to emphasize that WEAC absolutely agrees with petitioners that participants have legitimate property interests in the system as a whole. But a property interest in the system is different than a specific defined benefit. A perfect example, current employees, non-annuitant participants, absolutely have a property interest in the system, but they do not have any contractual right or property right in the money in the annuity reserve. By definition, all of the money in the annuity reserve must be used for two things, to pay current annuities or to pay dividends. There's no conceivable construction by which other participants in the system could claim that they have a contractual right in the money in the annuity reserve. There is clearly a distinction, then, between non-annuitant participants and annuitants. For current employees, their contract rights have not fully ripened. They have a property interest, but their contract rights have not fully vested. And those contract rights are not fully vested until one of three events occurs: either separation from the system, death, or retirement.
Who doesn't have rights that are currently vested? I'm sorry, I didn't catch the first part of that.
If I understand your question, I think what you're alluding to is my statement that the non-annuitant participants, in other words, current employees, by definition cannot have a contract right or a property interest in the monies in the annuity reserve, because those monies are strictly dedicated.
Are you saying that Justice Bablish does not have a property interest in as a participant in the
Does that mean that a current participant in the trust fund doesn't have a property interest in the monies of that fund? Is that what you're asserting?
No, and let me try to clarify that. I'm saying that there is a property interest in the system as a whole. In other words, in the integrity and security of the fund, that the money in the fund will only be used for proper trust purposes. In other words, that money cannot be transferred out, and that any accrued benefits or rights that they have earned for past service, those benefits are all protected. However, that does not translate to the proposition which I believe petitioners have invoked, which is that participants own every dollar that's in the system. And I'm saying that that cannot be true if you look at just that one example that I'm talking about, that current employees do not have a contract right in the money in the annuity reserve because that money is there to pay annuitants or to fund dividends.
But they do have a property right in the other three, don't they? They have a property right in the TAA and the employer reserve and the employee reserve. Because the annuity account is only for to be paying present obligations.
I would respectfully disagree with your answer in part, Your Honor, to this extent. I believe that the three reserves are separate and distinct, have separate functions, and I believe that if you look at Chapter 40 and the various contractual provisions that flow therefrom, you will see that the rights in the three also vary. In terms of the annuity reserve, we've already talked about that, belonging to current annuitants. In terms of the employee reserve, that's very easy to identify. Obviously, the money there is in separate individual accounts, and that's earned and accrued benefit money that will be used at some time to fund.
Whose property interest is that money?
All of the participants that are involved in it. The employer reserve, I believe, as we've addressed in our briefs and as my colleague Ms. Smith has mentioned, I believe the employer reserve is a funding mechanism and essentially is a sum sufficient account. And as long as the property interests are protected, the integrity of the system, the accrued benefits, and the actuarial soundness of the system, as long as we do not impinge any of the contract or property rights that any individual participant has, the employer reserve is simply a funding mechanism, a sum sufficient account, which they do not own any particular dollar therein.
That seems to be an argument totally contrary to the economic interests of your membership.
Well, I could see why you might think that, Your Honor, and that's why I said earlier on that we did not weigh in on this case very lightly. We've thought through this very carefully. Obviously, we want to represent our members the best that we can, and we don't want to take away any of their rights. But we believe that we have to be intellectually honest, and we have to look at what Chapter 40 provides. And I believe that what Chapter 40 provides is very clear distinctions in terms of the property rights that participants have. And it changes over time. It changes on when you enter the system. It changes on when you retire. It varies on if you're currently a participant who's capped because you started after 1981. There are changes over time. And so,
but you do admit that this argument is contrary to the economic interests of your membership.
I believe that it could be construed that way, yes.
Okay, so then it seems to me that contrary to what Ms. Smith says, this is taking money that at least arguably belongs to all the participants, including your membership.
Well, I would have to disagree to a certain extent with that comment, and here is why. I believe that as long as the formula benefit or the money purchase benefit is protected and the system is sound and money is not transferred out to be used for non-trust fund purposes, those are the defined contractual or property rights. If those are protected, I believe our members are protected, and I don't believe that they're necessarily being harmed. I believe that the flexibility that I'm talking about is necessary. I think that Chapter 40 and specifically 40.19, the legislature indicated that there needs to be a certain amount of flexibility. And when the state reserves the right to make changes, I think there are economic reasons that might be necessary. I think that The important thing here is to make sure that at any point, the line to be drawn is whether or not those contractual or property interests, as we've defined them, have been violated or tampered or abrogated in any way.
Counsel, let's say this isn't Act 11. Let's say this is Act 12. And let's say Act 12 says we're going to take $1 billion from the TAA account, and we're going to use it to fund the unfunded liabilities of the employer. Are you going to be standing here on behalf of your clients and saying that's fine?
Well, if I understand your question, when you say take $1 billion from the TAA and
transfer $1 billion from the TAA into the employer reserve account for purposes of funding the unfunded liability of employees, you're standing before us and saying it's okay to take money from the TAA account to fund the unfunded liability of the employers. Justice Babbage suggests that maybe that's contrary to your client's financial interest, but you know, you say that's fine. Legislature can do it. So I'm saying in Act 12, when the only thing the legislature does is take $1 billion, no other benefits, no increase to put in your pockets, and use it exclusively for funding the unfunded liabilities of the employer, are you going to be standing at the podium and saying, well, that's fine too?
If the factual basis for your question is that the money would only go from the TAA to the employer reserve for unfunded liability, the answer would be a resounding no. If, however, your question is a similar distribution where the money flows to the various respective accounts and then is credited to the individual accounts in the employee reserve, community reserve, and
so
forth.
You're fair enough. And so let's take this transfer. Let's take these monies. Let's say we've got the $4 billion, just like Act 11, and apparently $1.26 billion are in each of the three reserved accounts, roughly. Let's say not $200 million, but $1.26 in this legislation is to fund the unfunded liability of the employers. Are you going to be standing here and making the same argument that such a transfer is fine? No problem. No legal problem at all. In fact, court, you got to let the legislature do that.
Well,
are you going to be standing here making that same argument?
I think that it's first of all necessary to know it doesn't work in a vacuum. To simply say you're going to transfer this amount of money, it's important to understand the money that's there. And is the system actuarially sound?
Yeah.
And is the money being distributed?
Everything is the same. We've got a book of stipulations of facts and exhibits and everything. Everything is the same. With the exception that all of the $1.26 billion is to fund the employer's unfunded liability. Any problem with that? That's the only change
well,
in those facts.
Obviously, you would have political problems with that.
Yes, I'm not talking about the law. You're having legal problems with that, because when the legislature does that next year in Act 12, you can't take a different legal position. Do you have any legal problems with the legislature using $1.26 billion of this $4 billion to fund employers' unfunded account? You have any legal problems with that?
From a legal standpoint, I would say that based on the proposition as you set forward, if all other things being equal,
all the same,
I think that would be a very difficult pill for us to swallow, and politically it would be an outrage.
Right. I'm talking about legally, arguments. Right. Legally, is there any problem with that?
I don't believe there is, Your Honor, but I don't believe that the court needs to go that far. Based on the facts here today, I think it's important to understand that subsequent to Act 11, the ETF board did in fact lower contribution rates. Again, additionally, in Act 11, Section 27, Sub 3, there is a provision that clearly reiterates the authority that the ETF board has to maintain the actuarial funding of the system. And here, there does not simply appear to be any problem with the system being underfunded, or with any money being transferred out, or with any individual being denied vested accrued benefits that they have already earned for services rendered.
Counsel.
What?
Theoretically, if we accept Ms. Smith's argument, all you're doing is giving these people 2 years or 3 years of delay. So why is it even political suicide? But why would it be legal suicide? Why, if you're only giving him a 2.5 year delay, why is anybody upset about this?
Well,
and why do you need, and I'll ask, add something, why do I have to sweeten the deal for the people in the retirement system by saying I'm going to up the cap or give them more percent? I don't have to sweeten the deal. If it's okay to delay, in effect, payment of these contributions, it's okay. I don't have to sweeten it. Now, it may be better for you, and you have to make a balance of the benefits versus the potential detriments, but why do I have to sweeten it by giving any more benefits? I just move the whatever number you want, 200 million, 1.2 billion from TAA to another account.
Well, I think that the answer to that question is legally, I don't believe that you have to. But again, I think that that question is going much further afield than the facts that we have in this particular case.
How do you write an opinion that says 200 million is okay, but only when it's sweetened? 1.2 billion is not okay unless the sweetener is big enough. I mean, you know, we have to have a legal basis on which to hang that kind of opinion on.
I agree with you, Your Honor, and that's why I said that legally I don't believe that that requirement of a sweetener is necessary.
Mr. Sheehan, it's the legislature that votes for increases in benefits, for multipliers, for caps, for anything of that sort. If and employers, when that happens, employers have additional liability. Why would employers ever increase or agree to increase benefits if they never got any benefit out of good times? So long as the benefits are paid, what's wrong? I mean, I think that's part of where you're coming from. You're also freeing up $84 million for school districts because of this $200 million transfer. Isn't that true?
I'm not certain of the exact dollar amount, but yes, there is definitely going to be an effect.
You're not betraying your membership. You're looking at your membership. You got increased benefits. You freed up $84 million. The benefits are going to be paid. What more could be fairer, is Roundy Goose.
Your Honor has very succinctly put all the political arguments about why our membership feels pretty good about this particular act.
You're going to quit while you're ahead, sir?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Sheehan. Mr. Pines, you have about 5 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you.
I ask you quickly?
Yes.
In light of the retired teacher's decision a couple of years ago, how were your members hurt applying the principles of that case?
To this case?
Yeah.
Our members are injured because $200 million is gone from the trust fund. And it's very nice for this case to be argued in good economic times and to say, gee, the TAA has grown exponentially. It's got so much money, and what does it really matter? We don't know that these good economic times are going to last forever. In fact, the stock market may crash tomorrow. With that $200 million gone, potentially there will be a requirement for the employers to have to pay more money in. When the employers have to pay more money in, and the deputy sheriffs sit down with the county to negotiate their contract, the employer comes in and says, gee, we haven't got enough money for salary increases for you. Look at what we have to pay into the pension fund. That's how our members are potentially injured. But that's the problem. But taking
so you're hoping for bad times, or we're thinking?
No, I realize that.
You're saying to the court that you believe that there's a risk in getting that money, that $200 million. Is that what you're saying? Because you have doubt that the municipalities or people that the WPPA work for would not be able to pay that back?
What we're saying is, well, first of all, they might not be able to pay it back. But what we're saying is the money has to stay in the system. The employers will get a benefit from good times as the contribution rates go down, as they have gone down, as they have continued to go down as times have been good. The contribution rates have either stayed steady or gone down. If they stay steady, they're still dropping because there's inflation. So the employers will get the benefit of the good times. And they get the benefit of that $200 million staying in, because that $200 million is invested, it earns money, and to the extent that the fund is better funded and contribution rates go down, they get they get a benefit. But we are saying that we have a fundamentally different view of this system. When I heard the state arguing here is, there's just these contract rights. It's contract rights. As long as everybody is going to get paid, it's okay. And that's all that the contract rights are. And really, the employees don't own this money. This money is just a funding mechanism. That's all it is. That's their argument. It's just a funding mechanism. And these unfunded liabilities, they're not really a debt. They don't really belong to anybody. The trust fund doesn't really own them. They're just a funding mechanism. And we can use them any way we want. And I'm asserting very strongly, if you give the legislature on this point an inch, the legislature will take a mile. Now, three of you were legislators, and I think you know that that's true. There was $13 billion, almost $14 billion in the TAA. About a third of that was in the so-called employer reserve, which did not belong to the employers. There's nothing that would stop the legislature from saying, if you accept the state's position and we ex position, there is nothing to stop the state from saying, tomorrow, $4 billion is going to be a credit for against unfunded liabilities, everything in the employer reserve. And the answer that the state gives is, well, you know, that's okay, because we promise to pay. Well, that's not the way the system is set up. This system is set up so the employers pay into the fund, and the employees, the members of our organization, and WEAC, and every other public employer, doesn't have to rely on the promises of employers to pay in the future. The system is set up so the employers pay now. And the employees own that money. That's why this is a safe system. If you say the employees don't owe the money, and all they have is a contract for the employers to pay later, and these liabilities are just a funding mechanism, that fundamentally undermines the integrity of this pension system. Absolutely. And in this instance, this is a perfect example of what will happen. Now it's $200 million. And yeah, what's the purpose of it? The purpose of it has nothing to do with this trust fund. The purpose of it is to give property tax relief and to give to municipalities and to counties and to help fund the state budget. That's the purpose of this legislation. That's not a proper purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Pines. Mr. House, you have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you. I agree with the direction that Mr. Pines has gone. What has to be remembered here is the notion that money's going to get taken out for 21 months and then it's going to get put back in is just not true. Not true. It's replaced with a promise that contingently might or might not be fulfilled. That's what it is. It's simply borrowing cash out of that system by, instead of taking cash, taking a credit that is then used the same way you would use cash. And it frees up money in the budget. Now, when they say there's some sufficient funding here, they're talking about is not some, is something that is so long-term, it's almost imperceptible. That's why the calibration of funding and the calibration of all the mathematics that are involved in a system like this has to be done year after year and watched. Do you know that the unfunded liability, if an employer comes into the system and has $1 million of unfunded liability, that's a debt, and it's amortized over 40 years they have to pay it. So here they're going to take and suspend the payment for some 20-some-odd months, and then when the payment resumes, it resumes at the previous level. It doesn't get deferred. And then in the future, we keep calculating what is owed. The actuaries do it. And if the actuaries decide that the funding is insufficient and we need more money, then there's an increased contribution rate. And that increased contribution rate is then split between the employer and the employee. And in effect, because this system never contemplated these kinds of credits, okay, in effect what ends up happening is the employees start paying back through the BAC contribution a portion of the money that resulted in the shortchanging of the system, this money that was taken out. In this case, it's only $200 million. It may be fairly imperceptible in the short term. But if you give the okay to this kind of process and money starts pouring out of there in significant terms, not just pocket change like $200 million, then where are we? There will be a shortage at some point. Economic times will change. There will be a need to increase the contribution levels. My opponent says that that will be handled with some sufficient contributions. But not really, because those additions and the contribution rates are by statute now split between the employer and the employee on a 50-50 basis. And even if we had boom times, and there was a reduction in the contribution level because they were swimming in so much money and didn't need it to meet the obligations, even if we had those boom times, employees would be entitled to a reduction in what they need to contribute. But if money has been taken out, that's a reduction of the boom times as well. There would be a smaller reduction. So in effect, this process, because it's not contemplated in the structural mechanisms of this fund, would result in a reallocation of how and who funds this whole system. And that is a taking. You can't have the state taking money, sticking it in its pocket, and then turning around and telling the employees, now you pick up 50% of the shortfall later on.
That's a taking, any way you slice it. And I think it's really a disservice to pretend like this $200 million is going to specific credits on an employer-by-employer basis, and to pretend like it's not even a debt because we've got this commitment out there. Well, when anybody's ready to take those kinds of commitments in lieu of cash, they should line up here, because I'll make that deal with anybody. The fact is, we all know that cash is better. Cash is safer. Cash is more secure. Those debts will not, those IOUs will not pay the bills. And finally, if they don't pay the bills, here's what happens. Let's say that there's a shortfall because there are additional takings out of here of this type, and there's a shortfall, and there's economic pressure on the state to fund this. Some future employees are going to feel a heck of a lot of pressure to have their pension system discontinued altogether because we owe all this money to the people that we already owe it to. It really creates a lot of dislocations, and it's just a matter of how many dollars we're talking about.
Thank you, Mr. House. Thank you, Mr. Pines. Thank you, Mr. House. Thank you, Ms. Smith. And thank you, Mr. Shan, for all argument. And you may have set a record in this court. I think it's over 2 hours. So thank you for everyone else's patience. We are in recess until tomorrow morning at 9:45.